Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed, your host. Today, we're focusing on media in the Middle East. We'll hear from Hisham Kassem, a veteran publisher in Egypt. So are journalists truly independent now that the dictators are no longer dictating the coverage? Or have the new people in power simply picked up the practice of repressing opposing voices? Hisham, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you, David.
I wanted to let our listeners know a bit about you. You're building a newsroom now in Cairo, and you've been a longtime independent journalist in Egypt. Can you kind of bring us back to your beginnings in journalism in Egypt?
Sure. I launched the Cairo Times in 97, and it was a niche publication for expats and Egyptians who speak English. It was a weekly. I had a very difficult time with the Egyptian government. They sometimes banned me from printing in Egypt, and I would have to fly to Cyprus to print copies and bring them back on the plane as cargo with me and get them confiscated in the airport. And eventually they started threatening my advertisers, so they shut the money off. And I had to, unfortunately, fold it in 2004. But in the same year, I launched the first independent daily in 50 years. It was a joint stock company owned by a few big businessmen. It did very well, and I managed to retain editorial independence, but began to feel them breathing down my neck once the paper was a success and wanted to have favors done. So I resigned in 2006 with the objective of setting up a new publication where the difference would be in shareholder structure. But when I did take time off and saw the developments that happened in the newsroom and newsroom convergence, I spent about 2 years studying the model, going to different newspapers all over the world, taking things like video editing courses, which I'd never done before. I've always been in print.
Right.
But in order to be a content publisher, I had to go through that. And then it took me some time to find the right office space because I wanted a lease downtown Cairo with 2,000 square meters, and that was very difficult. But eventually I did, and then proceeded to design the newsroom.
Right.
It all went very well, but right now there's a reluctance to invest, so I'm not selling shares as quickly as I would like, but keeping the place and gradually finishing the newsroom, and hope to start the operation in 2012, where we would have a mobile phone news service, web, broadcast, video and audio, a TV station and a radio station, and a daily print paper, all coming from one newsroom.
Well, that's quite an endeavor. How is it different than the existing media there in Egypt? How will you stand out?
Well, again, this is going to be a very clearly liberal paper with a liberal persuasion. And again, with the daily paper, I don't intend to report yesterday's news as much as give added value. With yesterday's news, we would have already reported through other media yesterday. But the following day, instead of having a headline, like say the day Mubarak was ousted, where most of the headlines in Egypt said the people ousted Mubarak, mine could be something along the lines of fears of security deterioration in the upcoming weeks. Because everybody in Egypt already knows that Mubarak was ousted. And we would have reported that on news text messages, web, radio and TV as it was happening.
So it's in Egypt yesterday. Now the ruling generals swore in a new cabinet and gave the prime minister new powers. How would you report that in your new newsroom? What would be the analysis of what's happening now with the military and its seemingly maintaining control over the country?
Well, you know, I think this is an obscure time because I'm positive that the military will hand over power.
Right.
Okay. And what you have now, the ruling, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces that became the caretaker entity once Mubarak was ousted, have no political ambitions. But with the appointment of this new prime minister and his cabinet, I fear they might delay the full handover to a civilian elected authority, whether in government or president.
Okay, well, let's back up a bit and talk about what it was like to report under Mubarak. To put this in historical perspective, what's happening now?
Well, sure. There were three, to begin with, about 80% of Egypt's publications were registered abroad because it was practically impossible to get a license from the Mubarak regime. State security always got in the way, and they had the final word, even though officially they did not exist on paper. You did not have to apply to state security. But a young lieutenant in state security could have blocked the whole, the body that gives licenses, which is called the Supreme Press Council.
Uh-huh.
And by being registered abroad, you were subject to censorship. And in my first year publishing the Cairo Times, I used to hand over copies before publishing and negotiate. They'd ask me to take pieces out. I'd try to keep them in. I used everything from slamming my hand on the table, fist on the table, to begging, to, you know, whatever. That was what was available at the time. But a year later, I had a mega fallout with them and said I would not hand them any more galleys before printing. And this meant a lot of trouble, and there were loads of times when the publication was censored.
Yeah, I have a quote from one of your former colleagues that she said that she called you an uncompromising curmudgeon. Would you describe yourself that way?
Well, I mean, I guess after all those years, yes, I can say that. Maybe I didn't know at the time, but there came a point where I thought this is unethical to accept their interference.
So,
and later with Al Masri Lyoum, which had a local license, I had 9 years ago told state security not to summon me again because summons is illegal. And they were just bullying me around. And at some point I put my foot down and said, next time you want to talk to me, you'll have to do a cease and arrest and bring me here to interrogate me, but these unofficial summons, no more. So that terminated any dialogue I had with them.
Did you ever feel?
They used to,
Did you ever feel physically threatened or at risk when this was happening?
Look, it's a different life for me. Yes, for 20 years I did not feel safe. Whether in attempts to enter my flat, God knows why, or the regular surveillance and phone stabbed, and it was not a very comfortable life, but I got used to it.
Do you have family there in Cairo?
No, I think that's one of the losses. I never was in a position to raise a family, and I always was put myself in a position where if they made an arrest or pressed charges, I would not compromise. I don't think that could have been the case if I had a family. I would have felt some responsibility towards children and a wife,
right,
as opposed to, you know, being single, where you, if you go to jail, you're on your own. Again, with Al-Masri اليوم, they would call the editor furious at something that was published, and he would come in saying they're really annoyed about this, and I'd say, if there's anything factually incorrect, we'll stand corrected tomorrow and retract it. However, if not, we maintain our position. And he would say, they're saying it is correct, but this is the wrong time to publish it, and I would answer, that's politics. We are here in the information business. We gather information, we process it, and sell it to people once we can verify the correctness of that information. So no deals. And I continued that way till eventually I resigned.
Now, was your experience similar to other independent journalists in Egypt?
No, not really. No. I think the only one who was as uncompromising as I was Ibrahim Issa of the Dastur. But I can openly say that the compromising characterized media under Mubarak.
When the revolution was in its height, what was it like reporting then? And was there more intense censorship? Tell us what it was like reporting at that time.
It was funny because state media were bending over backwards to twist facts. And at times when there would be bloodshed on Tahrir Square, they would have their camera on the Nile or, you know, broadcasting love songs or whatever. And the flagship paper of the state, Al-Ahram, the day following this disgraceful scene where Mubarak sent people on horseback and camel to attack the protesters, their headline said, the millions come out to support Mubarak.
Yeah.
Now, again, with the privately owned media, they were quite shy. You know, very careful, not sure if Mubarak is going to come out on top and then have his revenge if they report properly. But then it completely changed the day after. And Mubarak's own media turned against him as if they were always against him, with headlines like the Al-Ahram, the flagship paper, saying the people have brought down the regime. Most of Mubarak's media has lost its editorial proposition when they did 180 degrees on him and are at a loss. They seem to be looking for a new master to serve. They don't know how to operate independently. I don't think that they have long with us. Their days are numbered because, again, Mubarak was spending so much money to keep his mouthpiece alive. And when the figures come out, people are going to realize they're being deprived from healthcare, transportation, education in order to keep that. And I think if Mubarak took a moment and thought about all the money he put in his propaganda machine and wondered if he turned that money to healthcare or services to the people, if they might have rose against him like
okay.
they did.
Before we, I want to get in a bit to how the media is reporting the Mubarak trial and the efforts to form a constitution and a democratic parliament. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalistprogram@gmail.com or on our Facebook page. So what is there a wide range of reporting on these major events happening now in Egypt? And how is the state media dealing with this? Are they, you said they're looking for new masters. Is the military their new master?
Well, yes. I mean, the military is their new master. But again, I don't envy them. Military, by definition, you know, do not like transparency, and that's, I mean, military in Sweden or India or the United States, they have a problem with that, and they have a problem with criticism. The quality of coverage has really been poor mm-hmm. In the state-owned media. Again, with the private media, privately owned media, I have a feeling that they failed what happened in January, I still think we had an uprising or a populist revolt as opposed to a revolution, and it will only be a revolution when we have elected a new parliament and president. At that point, we will have brought in our own rulers by ourselves. So we rise against Mubarak in the streets, the millions go out, and then the millions go out again, but this time to vote in a new government. But until that's done, I still insist it's a revolt. Again, they raised the expectations of what we should expect under the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, the ruling entity in Egypt now, because they expected reform to start. And I don't think that the military school of management is capable of economic or political reform.
So do you think this is going to come to a head fairly soon, or what do you see as the timeline for the changes? Will people just kind of wait and see for a while to see how the constitution is drawn and who's chosen in parliament?
Well, again, like I told you, the results of the first round of three rounds in the elections shocked everybody because the Islamic parties got together about 60% of parliament. And there are fears that they will basically write a constitution that will eventually lead to the wiping out of Egyptian identity. And in the meantime, the military have made a statement that is still obscure. It's not very clear because it only happened yesterday. That it was actually one of them speaking to the Guardian newspaper about handover and who is going to form the committee that will draft the constitution, saying that the results of the parliament are not very representative, which is quite true. But again, it's putting us in a bit of a dilemma.
Why is it not representative? What are the dynamics of this election? Are the youth not coming out to vote?
Well, okay. No, the turnout was unbelievable. 62% of Egyptians voted in the first round, as opposed to 8%. That was the highest under Mubarak, in which 5% at least used to be bussed by force by the Mubarak regime to the polling stations to vote for his party. So the turnout was huge. But then you're talking about 54% who had never voted in their life before. I stood in the queues. There were people who really did not understand the process but wanted to participate. The Islamist parties, in violation to the law, were distributing pamphlets of their candidates, which is a violation. In the runoff last Monday, I actually went to the judge, the presiding judge over the polling station where I voted, complaining about one of the Islamist parties outside having a kiosk with advert propaganda in it and a laptop where they were helping people to go to their to locate their polling station, and this is in violation.
Okay.
But I can't attribute that to the mere landslide in their favor. However, the bulk of them have been working as opposed to the new parties that have evolved under Mubarak, because under Mubarak it was practically very difficult to get a license for a party. And the Islamists mainly were able to work out of the mosque as opposed to the secular and liberal forces who really had no platform to work out of.
Now
so the result, I don't think, is very representative.
Okay.
But we'll have to wait and see the next two rounds and the outcome, and then see where we go from there.
Okay. Is it frustrating for you to be on a sideline somewhat? Are you able to, or any of your people able to report through blogs or websites?
No, not really. I'm focusing on understanding there's a major change happening in Egypt, and I want to be able to monitor it. And I felt quite happy because the editorial proposition I had set for this whole new project, I think will be able to go in depth in Egyptian society and come out with more than we were able to in the past to educate and inform people about what's happening in Egypt. Okay. So I spend most of my time doing that. I only engage on Twitter and Facebook and social media.
You have a good number of followers?
I have over 10,000 followers.
That's a pretty significant number. Now, let's talk about the media environment a bit broader in Egypt. I know that the BBC Online, for example, has had a huge increase in the number of people viewing. And what are some of the other activities that are happening in the media in Egypt? Newcomers, both satellite TV and more local
yes.
offerings?
Uh-huh. Yes, it's mushrooming, and loads of TV stations are appearing, new newspapers are appearing. However, again, I have my reservations against the type of ownership where a single individual sets up a set of TV stations and then starts buying more and making offers to buy more. And my decision to resign from the Al-Masri Al-Youm, where I had basically three big shareholders, and it became very clear that sooner or later they will have their way. But my decision started in 2006 when I was with the World Association of Newspapers in Moscow, and the president of the association got up and criticized Putin for his track record with media. Putin got up and defended himself, and for the first time, somebody who suppressed media made sense to me. He said, "You don't understand what you're talking about. Media was owned by the Communist Party. When it collapsed, almost overnight, five or six oligarchs bought it and were making public opinion in Russia, a matter that could have led to the state to disintegrate." And I realized that, and I feared that that's what's coming in Egypt. And the beginning of my decision to resign, I think, was at that moment. So I'm not too happy, as much as I always welcome new media appearing and more information circulating, but I have my strong reservations against the type of ownership of the new media, which very soon will replace all state-owned media.
Now, I know that a lot of the local media is going to have to depend on advertising. And what's the state of the economy there? What's life like in Egypt right now? And what's the business atmosphere?
Right now, it's disastrous. Nobody's investing. There are fears. People don't know where the country's going. But on the whole, even though our per capita expenditure on advertising is $6 annually, still, it's an 80 million nation, so there is enough money for lots of new media to appear. But at present, these are critical times. Media is not generating enough.
Well, do you think that the proliferation of the new media could dilute the control of that handful of investors, the people who
want
to pull the strings?
When you say new media, do you mean social media?
Social media, startups, expansion of outside networks like BBC?
Well, I don't think new media will ever dilute mainstream media. It plays a very important role because it shows us more. It goes into things which we can later explore, and it keeps us honest because they monitor us very closely. And some of the best criticism you can read on mainstream media is within social media. Again, with startups, etc., yes, I think that will eventually happen, but I'm worried about the near future of the country when it comes to media.
The I know that there's been some reports of physical intimidation, particularly of a few female journalists there in Egypt. Are you seeing more of that kind of intimidation of journalists as this starts to come to a head with the military?
The intimidation is not really coming from the military. Unfortunately, sexual harassment is quite widespread in Egypt of women. There have been a few very sad cases of molesting and attacking female journalists, especially in the Tahrir Square. In one case, one of them called me, actually trapped in an apartment in the square, and I had to go in there and take her out, and it was a bit of a nightmare. But I don't think it's by the authorities, really. It's a wider phenomena that has to be addressed seriously in Egypt.
Look, taking the lens way back, do you think that what's happening in Egypt is somewhat similar to what's happening in some of the other Arab Spring countries? Or is each country really different and there aren't similar trends? How would you put this in perspective in the Arab world?
There are similarities, but nothing is identical or nothing makes a path for another. And in the case of Tunisia, when you look at their situation, there are major differences. The demographics is one. You know, there are 10 million people, we're 80 million. Their education has been their strong point. So again, that reflects on the political course. Our education, unfortunately, is one of our weakest points.
Okay. I think I need to we have to wrap up here. But I wanted to I hope that we can talk again once you launch your
sure.
operations there. We'd love to hear how it's going. So maybe early next year when things are up and running, we can do that. So I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Our director is Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers engineered the audio. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Jessica Popovac is the lead producer for this show. Thank you for listening and watching our program. And now stay with us for Free Press Watch.
And now, Global Journalists Free Press Watch, where each week we bring you a roundup of major events in press freedom around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. Honduran journalist Luz Marina Paz Villalobos was shot and killed in Tegucigalpa Tuesday, along with her driver. Paz was the host of a morning news program and previously worked for Radio Globo, a radio station known for its outspoken criticism of the 2009 ouster of former President Manuel Zelaya. The AP is reporting that gunmen on motorcycles shot at their car 37 times. Authorities said they were investigating several potential motives for the attack, including her work. She was 38 years old. 12 Honduran journalists have been murdered since March 2010, at least three in direct reprisal for their work. A 2010 CPJ special report found a pattern of botched and negligent investigative work regarding the killings. And a Rwandan journalist and former soldier who used to criticize that country's president was shot dead last Thursday while at a bar in Uganda. Charles Ingabire left his home country of Rwanda in 2007 and was given political refugee status. While in Uganda, he created a news website critical of the Rwandan government and army. He was reportedly threatened just 2 months ago and told to quit publishing the site. The Committee to Protect Journalists is reporting that he recently applied for resettlement to a third country, but the UN High Commission for Refugees rejected his application. As always, you can find links to these and other stories on our website at www.globaljournalist.org. On behalf of everyone at Global Journalist Radio, thank you for joining us.